This is episode number 40 of the Merry Podcast, entitled Christmas 1944.
You're listening to the Merry Podcast of MyMerryChristmas.com.
I want to live again, and I want to look them straight in the eye, and I want to tell them what a cheap, lying, no-good, rotten, four-flushing, low-life, snake-licking, dirt-eating, inbred, overstuffed, ignorant, blood-sucking, dog-kissing, brainless...
Yeah, there's a lot of bad isms floating around this world, but one of the worst is commercial. Makeup, even in Brooklyn it's the same.
That thing had nine lives, she just spent them all.
Woo! I triple dog dare you!
I don't believe you're an angel. I think you're a demon right out of...
Oh, Henry, don't say that.
Does someone need a hug?
Tomorrow is Christmas. It's practically here.
Keep the change, you filthy animal.
Sentimental hogwash.
What was the last thing you and Charlie did before you went to bed Christmas Eve?
We shared a bowl of sugar, some shots of brown liquor. Played my shotguns, field dressed a cat, looked for women.
I'm the worst toy maker in the world. I'm a cotton-headed ninny muggins.
My mouth's bleeding, Bert! My mouth's bleeding! Doo-doo pedals! Doo-doo! There they are! Bert! What do you know about that? Merry Christmas!
Merry Christmas!
Merry Christmas. Merry Christmas!
Merry Christmas!
Merry Christmas! Merry Christmas and welcome to this, the 40th episode of the Merry Podcast of MyMerryChristmas.com. My name is Jeff Westover, founder of My Merry Christmas, where we are in our 23rd year of being the Internet's longest ongoing celebration of Christmas. The Merry Podcast is a joint production of Merry Christmas Radio and Kringle Radio, our two year-round radio stations dedicated to all things Christmas. You can find Merry Christmas Radio on live365.com and Kringle Radio at kringleradio.com. In our study of Christmas history, we've noticed some trends that are cyclical. Christmas seems to come in and out of fashion. It mirrors world history by the attitudes toward it. And as the world continues to shift and further embroil itself in turmoil, Christmas becomes kind of a bellwether for life itself. In the end, Christmas always survives. It teaches lessons, and it endures. But every once in a while, a Christmas season comes around that has a real lasting impact. Perhaps it is against a backdrop of a global event, a political crisis, or even a cultural debut of some element of Christmas that changes it forever. We have talked of such Christmases before here on the Merry Podcast. In fact, this year we celebrate the 100th anniversary of an event that will get talked about a great deal this season, the Christmas Truce, which occurred a century ago while the world was engaged in World War I. We're glad to remember that event, and we will participate in the retelling of that story. But for us, there is a bigger Christmas in the 20th century, one that bears a little more examination. Now, it is usually my goal in each episode of the podcast to present a variety of Christmas information, something of music, maybe a little news, certainly an exploration of history and tradition. And it is all intended to provide insight and entertainment as part of our ongoing celebration of Christmas. But in this episode, we're going to touch all of those bases by focusing on one topic, indeed, on one Christmas season, the Christmas of 1944. Now, it was admittedly a Christmas before my time. I wasn't there. But like all of you, I was impacted by that Christmas in a very personal way, and I continue to be so. We will begin with the number one hit of 1944, a non-Christmas song with some interesting Christmas connections. Not only is this performed by Bing Crosby, the most immortal name in all of Christmas music, he performs this number one song backed by the Williams Brothers Quartet, featuring vocals from 16-year-old Andy Williams, who would in later years go down in history as Mr. Christmas for his own contributions to Christmas music.
Would you like to swing on a star? Carry moonbeams home in a jar and be better off than you are? Or would you rather be a mule? A mule is an animal with long, funny ears. Kicks up at anything he hears.
His back is brawny, but his brain is weak. He's just plain stupid with a stubborn streak.
And by the way, if you hate to go to school, you may grow up to be a mule.
Or would you like to swing on a star? Carry moonbeams home in a jar and be better off than you are.
Or would you rather be a pig?
A pig is an animal with dirt on his face. His shoes are a terrible disgrace. He has no manners when he eats his food. He's fat and lazy and extremely rude.
But if you don't care a feather or a fig, you may grow up to be a pig.
Or would you like to swing on a star? Carry moonbeams home in a jar and be better off than you are.
Or would you rather be a fish?
A fish won't do anything but swim in a brook. He can't write his name or read a book. To fool the people is his only thought. And though he's slippery, he still gets caught.
But then if that sort of life is what you wish, you may grow up to be a fish. New kind of jumped up slippery fish, and all the monkeys are in the zoo.
Every day you meet quite a few,
so you see it's all up to you. You can be better than you are. You could be swinging on a star.
This number one song comes from the number one movie of the year 1944, a movie starring Bing Crosby as Father O'Malley in Going My Way, a non-Christmas movie often remembered and fondly replayed each Christmas season for its Christmas elements. The movie and the music were not just a hit. It won 7 Academy Awards, including recognition for Best Picture, Director, Actor, Supporting Actor, Writing, Story, and Music. The movie cemented Crosby as a movie star and not just a recording artist. He was one of the first true superstars of American culture in radio with music, and later in movies and on television as an actor, singer, and performer. But Going My Way was symptomatic of the American psyche in 1944. It was a determined story of choosing right over wrong, of replacing the old with the new, of becoming better and being better, as the message of Swinging on a Star suggests. We can be better than what we are. Crosby wasn't the only artist making this suggestion in 1944. It was almost as if the American public was being called to repentance for something. What was it? What was the great sin of America? It was a reluctance to go to war. It was a rallying cry of sacrifice, one of pursuing the greater good. As Dickens would put it, it made the business of mankind the business of America. The King Cole Trio also had a hit earlier in 1943 that talked about this attitude adjustment and the need of the American public to straighten up and fly right.
I was buzzer took a monkey for a ride in the air. The monkey thought that everything was on the square. The buzzer tried to throw the monkey off of his back. The monkey grabbed his neck and said, "Now listen, Jack. Straighten up and fly right. Straighten up and fly right. Straighten up and fly right. Cool down, Papa, don't you blow your top. Ain't no use in diving. What's the use of jiving? Straighten up and fly right. Cool down, Papa, don't you blow your top." The buzzer told the monkey, "You are choking me. Release your hold and I will set you free." The monkey looked the buzzer right dead in the eye and said, "Your story's so touching, but it sounds just like a lie. Straighten up and fly right. Straighten up and stay right. Straighten up and fly right. Cool down, Papa, don't you blow your top."
Going My Way ends on a Christmas note, much like the year of 1944 itself, and it suggests that there is more good work to do. Aside from a brief moment of World War II propaganda, the film makes little mention of what occupied the minds of Americans in 1944, but the truth of the matter was that life itself had become all about the war and defeating the enemies of freedom. Over the course of 5 years, an amazing shift had taken place in America. Tired from nearly a decade of rough living made necessary by the Great Depression, and stung by the memories of a horrific experience from modern war in World War I, America took an isolationist stance when Hitler began storming Europe in the late 1930s.
It is right to point out that the unfortunate events of these recent years have been based on the use of force or on the threat of force. And it seems to me clear, even at the outbreak of this great war, that the influence of America should be consistent in seeking for humanity a final peace which will eliminate, as far as it is possible to do so, the continued use of force between nations. I have said not once but many times that I have seen war and that I hate war. I say that again and again. I hope the United States will keep out of this war. I believe that it will. And I give you assurance and reassurance that every effort of your government will be directed toward that end.
As the nations of Europe began to fall, the surge in nationalism and patriotism in the United States began to rise and was reflected in popular music and film of the day. America was threatened, and nobody pointed that out better than Winston Churchill in 1940.
"But if we fail, then the whole world, including the United States, including all that we have known and cared for, will sink into the abyss of a new dark age, made more sinister and perhaps more protracted by the lights of perverted science. Let us therefore brace ourselves to our duty, and so bear ourselves that if the British Empire and its commonwealths last for 1,000 years, men will still say, this was their finest hour."
But despite the strife in Europe, America just was not ready.
"Put away the guns, put the bombs on the shelf. Stop this war, the cats are killing themselves." "Boy, they're shooting them up and they're shooting them live. they even got wigs and shooting them fire. A big bum hit a boat out in the sea. The sailors jumped up, hollered, "What you doing to me?"
Then on a bright Sunday morning in early December 1941, everything changed.
Yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy, the United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan.
Wanting war or not, America was now in it, and life for everyone was about to really change.
Hurrah, hurrah, I shout the jubilee. Hurrah, hurrah, the army's the life for me. My uniform is a masterpiece. The seat of my pants looks like a valise. I smile at the girl and she hollers, "Police, I'm in the army now."
For as much as the shift from peace to war had taken place, life itself didn't stop in 1941. It changed, but it didn't stop. For American culture, it was a time dominated by Glenn Miller's big band sound.
Glenn Miller's rise to stardom was similar to the story of Bing Crosby. Truly American and from the Midwest, Miller's story is one of a boy and his trombone raised on Midwestern Christian values. Discouraged after bouncing around to various orchestras and big bands in the 1930s, Miller experimented with developing a unique sound, embracing jazz and popularizing dance as well as music with modern arrangements that drove jazz critics crazy. But with the onset of World War II, Miller, though too old for the draft, set aside sure income of better than $20,000 a week and a lucrative career that by 1942 had expanded into the movies by joining the war effort. He tried to join the Navy, but was rejected due to his age, so he wrote to an Army general who took him up on Miller's offer to lead a modernized Army band. He eventually transferred to the Army Air Force and was given the rank of captain. "America means freedom," Miller was heard to say, "and there's no expression of freedom quite so sincere as music." Music was his contribution to the war effort, and Captain Miller worked the theater of war in both America and Europe as the American buildup to the fight took place prior to 1944. Nearly every major film and music artist of the 1940s involved themselves in the war effort in some way, and patterned their work after the efforts made by most Americans. Christmas was central to the sentiment of the time. First, from the pen of Irving Berlin and the talent of Bing Crosby, the song of White Christmas not only summed up what they felt about Christmas of the past, but also of Christmas of the time. In 1941, Crosby released White Christmas, which was later used in a movie production called Holiday Inn in 1942. From that picture, here is Bing Crosby singing the duet with Martha Means.
I'm dreaming of a white Christmas, just like the ones I used to know, where the treetops glisten and children listen to hear sleigh bells in the snow. I'm dreaming of a white Christmas, with every Christmas card I write, may your days be merry and bright, and may all your Christmases be white. I'm dreaming of a white Christmas,
just like the ones I used to know,
where the treetops glisten.
Where the treetops glisten
and children listen.
And children listen
to hear
sleigh bells in the snow. I'm dreaming of a white Christmas. Christmas card I write,
may your days be merry and bright, and may all your Christmases be.
The story of America's involvement in the war tends to focus on the efforts made by the Allies after the invasion at Normandy in 1944. The bigger story was the change in American society and the gearing up for the war machine needed to fight on two major fronts against the Japanese in the Pacific and the Germans in Europe. Every family has stories from that time period. Speaking for my own family, I cannot think of one member of those generations who didn't get involved in the war or didn't feel the shift in their lives because of it. My mother was born in 1943. She had all of 1 month with her father before he shipped off to Europe in the spring of that year, never to return. In 1943, my father was all of about 18 months old, and he was living with my grandparents where they had taken new jobs as schoolteachers in the far, desolate, isolated west deserts of Utah at a Japanese relocation center. For my parents, these war years from 1942 to 1945 set the entire course of their lives. For their parents, and those of what we now call the greatest generation, life was not as it was expected to be for these former children of the Great Depression. Leaving the land of their upbringing, joining the military, and many of them facing death at such a young age was not what anyone expected to be doing. But everyone was doing it, and coping with it all the best way that they could.
The thrill of grammar school romances, I miss the junior prom and graduation dances, the gossip in assembly halls. I'm homesick, that's all. I miss the gang that hangs around at Miller's.
devouring chocolate sodas with those whipped cream fillers. The girl I promised I would call, I'm homesick, that's all. I miss the midnight services on Christmas Eve, and the joy when Christmas morning came. I miss the scramble for the wishbone every Sunday, and the big Thanksgiving football game. I miss the times I had to set the table. I miss the rolls my mother made when she was able. The fragrant bonfires in the fall. I'm homesick, that's all.
The story is told of young sailors serving on the battleship North Carolina around Christmas of 1943. The chaplain on the battleship knew that the crew was feeling homesick as they were expected to be overseas during the holiday season, and for many of them it was the first Christmas away from home. We tend to think of these men as men, but in fact many of them were just young boys, ages 18, 19, and 20. Many of these sailors were, and some of them were young fathers for the first time. This chaplain had an idea, collecting $5 from each of them that had kids and arranging to send that money to Macy's, that they might be able to buy gifts using the money provided for the crew's family, and to have that gift mailed to their homes in time for Christmas, a kind of sub for Santa project. As Christmas approached, the servicemen on the ship gathered for the annual Christmas show that involved songs and skits and entertainment for the troops aboard the battleship North Carolina. When that entertainment had ended, the chaplain revealed his surprise. What he did not know was that when Macy's received the money from the chaplain along with the list of addresses, they thought that in addition to just giving gifts to these military families, they should also do something for the sailors aboard the battleship North Carolina. Since they had the addresses of all the servicemen's homes, they reached out to each family and asked if they wanted to come to Macy's to film a special message to their loved one who would not be able to be home for Christmas. Well, you can imagine the scene. The men aboard the battleship sat there and saw their wives and children and loved ones appear before them on a screen, and these rugged sailors watched and wept and rejoiced. They weren't home for Christmas, but what made their home special was the Christmas gift they received on that December 25th of 1943. Stories such as this were common for any serving in the armed forces, and spending Christmas away from home in 1943 was actually something to overcome for many who had left their lives behind to serve in the armed forces. But it wasn't just for those who were serving. It was also top of mind for everyone in the country. People like my grandparents, who were in the United States but far from home that Christmas. The war put them where they were, and there was nothing that they could do about it. Bing Crosby recorded a single in October of 1943, which seemed to sum up perfectly what everyone was feeling for that Christmas away from home. Home was where they wanted to be, if only in their dreams.
I'll be home for Christmas. You can plan on me. Please have snow and mistletoe and presents on the tree. Christmas Eve will find me where the love light gleams. I'll be home for Christmas. If only in my dreams I'll be home for Christmas. And presents on the tree. Christmas Eve will find me
about Christmas 1943 was at that point in the war nobody knew when it would be over and that they would be home for good. The future they knew meant overcoming odds that no one really could calculate. How long it would take, what the cost would be in lives and blood, was all really unknown as 1943 turned to 1944. The differences between Christmas 1943 and Christmas 1944 were many. 1943 was, for most, their first Christmas away from home. It was natural to be homesick and to experience a Christmas that was so different from what they had ever known before. But Christmas 1944, they all knew, could be the worst yet. Many faced the specter that not only would they not be home that Christmas, they might not ever get home again at all. The task before them was enormous. Americans largely knew that they hadn't really yet taken the fight to the Germans or the Japanese. That was coming in 1944, and everybody knew it. It was all hands on deck, even from artists like Frank Sinatra.
The Sixth War Loan Drive now is here. There are many reasons why. For all the things that we hold dear, let's buy and buy and buy. Here comes the war bond man. Here comes the war bond man. He's priceless since the war began. Welcome the war bond man. The Jap, as you should know, will be the toughest foe. We've got to win, but that takes dough. Back up the war bond man. We have a score to settle on that far Pacific shore. Before we're done, the rising sun will set to rise no more. Here comes the war bond man. Here comes the war bond man.
In fact, the war was what 1944 was all about. Bing Crosby aside, the airwaves were full of music like this.
We're gonna have to slap the dirty little Jap, and Uncle Sam's the guy who can do it. We'll skin that streak of yellow from the sneaky little fella, and he'll think a cyclone struck him when we're through it. We'll take that double crosser to the old woodshed. We'll start right on his bottom and we'll go to his head. When we get done with him, he'll wish that he was dead. We've gotta slap a dirty little Jap.
One of the biggest misconceptions about World War II has to do with women. Women served at home in roles never before seen, hence the enduring image of Rosie the Riveter. But women in uniform served as never before, too.
Do, 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 do. class Private Mary Brown. She wore that uniform like a million-dollar gown. How my heart would leap when she drove the Jeep with the one big stripe on her arm. And it seemed to me that a PFC stood for perfect feminine charm. First class Private Mary Brown. Oh, how she smiled goodbye when they shipped me out of town. Let the big guns roar, let me win this war, 'cause I want to hurry right back to first class Private Mary Brown, my wonderful wife.
First class Private Mary Brown.
Death as an influence on life and on Christmas yet to come was something that everybody had to deal with.
There's a broken toy in the stocking, hanging there on the Christmas tree. And the story's told by a star of gold and the light on the Christmas tree. Bless all the angels up in heaven. May they watch o'er him oh so tenderly. There's an empty chair at the table and the light Christmas tree.
These heavy thoughts hung over everything. Another big hit at the theaters in 1944 was the movie Meet Me in St. Louis. It brought to the collection of Christmas classics a song we still hear. But put in the context of 1944, the song rings a little more solemn now.
Your heart be light. Next year all our troubles will be out of sight. Have yourself a merry little Christmas. Make the Yuletide gay. Next year all our troubles will be miles away. Once again, as in olden days, happy golden days of yore. Will be near to us once more. Someday soon we all will be together. If the fates allow. Until then we'll have to muddle through somehow. So have yourself a merry little Christmas.
The worst of the war was ahead of us, and all the nation knew it, while Great Britain, and especially France, Belgium, and Poland, and other areas of Europe had lived with war for 5 long years, Americans, other than the shocking news of December 1941, had been spared its horrors. That was to come in 1944, and everybody knew it. On June 6, 1944, the Allies invaded, and America waited for the bad news to come in.
My fellow Americans, last night, when I spoke with you about the fall of Rome, I knew at that moment that troops of the United States and our allies were crossing the channel in another and greater operation. It has come to pass with success thus far. And so, in this poignant hour, I ask you to join with me in prayer. Almighty God, our sons, pride of our nation, this day have set upon a mighty endeavor, a struggle to preserve our republic, our religion, and our civilization, and to set free a suffering humanity.
The devil and Mr. Hitler are trying to make a team. The devil and Mr. Hitler are too bashful to be seen. The devil has horns so long and sharp, and Hitler is a fiend. The devil and Mr. Hitler are trying to make a team. The devil and Mr. Hitler are trying to make a date. The devil and Mr. Hitler, they are both just like a snake. They've invaded other countries and they fill them full of hate. And now they think that they can come to our United...
That America was engaged in a moral battle, there can be no doubt. The total mobilization of society to take down Hitler and Hirohito was complete. Nearly all were dedicated to it. By the time Christmas came around, entertainers like Glenn Miller played their part. Folks involved in the war, it was no secret that Christmas 1944 would be different. What they didn't know was that it would be Christmas nonetheless, full of love, lessons, sacrifice, beauty, romance, tradition, and yes, even peace. What begins now are true stories from Christmas 1944, stories never to be forgotten from a season like no other in Christmas history. We begin out in the far Pacific. On each night of the week that preceded Christmas Eve in 1944, a lot of American lives had been lost while trying to hold an island in the South Pacific. Being foreigners, the Americans were at a disadvantage because they didn't know the area or terrain. The Japanese, though, knew the island well and had a distinct advantage, especially at night. On each of those nights prior to Christmas Eve, the Japanese would stealthily find their way into position where the destruction of the American troops was certain. GIs who had kept journals recorded their thoughts that Christmas Eve. They wrote down how it felt that night, knowing that it may likely be their last on Earth. They climbed into their foxholes, and as a lovely reminder of home and Christmases past, some of them even hung stockings on their bayonets. And they waited, just as they waited each night for the past week, for the stroke of midnight, gunshots, and death. But this night would be different, even though it started out very much the same. As the sun went down and the moon came up, they heard the stealthy steps of the enemy approaching, positioning themselves and preparing to fight. Some of the soldiers began to pray. Some began to simply think and wonder. As midnight was about to strike, from one of the foxholes, a beautiful voice was heard singing this song. At first, it was just one voice singing, next a duet, then a trio, and finally a chorus. It was followed by O Little Town of Bethlehem and ended with Silent Night. three Christmas hymns brought that evening to a silent close. It was indeed a silent night. Not a gun was fired. Why? What caused those two opposing forces to, at least for a moment, have peace on earth and goodwill toward men? And those beautiful Christmas songs is a secret ingredient. That secret ingredient is love, and it lives in divine music. When it is present, hate and envy and resentment and bigotry cannot exist. Light is stronger than dark, and love is stronger than hate. From the White House, President Roosevelt took to the microphone to address the nation that Christmas Eve of 1944.
The tide of battle has turned, slowly but inexorably, against those who sought to destroy civilization. And so on this Christmas Day, we cannot yet say when our victory will come. Our enemies still fight fanatically. They still have reserves of men and military power. But they themselves know that they and their evil works are doomed. We pray that until then, God will protect our gallant men and women in the uniforms of the United Nations. That He will receive into His infinite grace those who make their supreme sacrifice in the cause of righteousness. We pray that with victory will come a new day of peace on earth, in which all the nations of the earth will join together for all time.
Somewhere behind German lines, reminiscent of a Christmas a generation before, soldiers from both sides found commonality in Christmas they quite by accident celebrated together. Here is an eyewitness account.
December 1944. The battered German army launched its last great offensive along an 85-mile front in Belgium's Ardennes Forest. The infamous Battle of the Bulge. Nearly 16,000 American soldiers would lose their lives. Another 60,000 would be wounded or captured. It was the costliest battle the United States would wage in any war. Within earshot of the fighting, on the edge of the Ardennes Forest, stood a small isolated cabin. There, Fritz Vinken, a 12-year-old German boy, lived with his mother, Elizabeth. Fritz's father, Hubert, had moved his family to the cabin for safekeeping. But life in the forest was difficult. While Hubert served as a civilian baker for the German army 20 miles away, Fritz and his mother struggled to put food on the table.
My father thought, like everybody else, that the war would be ended, would be over by Christmas. But it was not to be. And our stay in this shack was longer than we anticipated.
Christmas Eve 1944 arrived with an air of sadness and uncertainty. Hubert has still not returned, and his family was resigned to the fact that they would be spending the holiday without him.
Ich weiß, heute ist Weihnachten. Aber weißt du, wenn kommen könnte, würde bestimmt da sein. Bestimmt.
Fritz's mother tried to make the evening as festive as possible. She scraped together a Christmas meal of a few potatoes and a scrawny rooster.
Papa?
My mother blew out the candle and went to the door, and I went with her. She opened the door, and there were these soldiers.
Ja, bitte?
Good evening, ma'am. Do you speak English?
Nein.
We're Americans.
They tried to talk to us, but my mother didn't speak English.
Our friend's been shot. Can we come inside for a while, please?
My mother just looked, and she looked at the guy sitting in the snow.
Kommt rein.
Thank you.
Until finally my mother, after, that seems to be like an eternity to me, she asked him to come in.
Hier aufs Bett, da ist es am besten.
Fritz's mother knew full well that harboring the enemy was punishable by death, but she was more than willing to take the risk. The injured soldier had been shot in the leg and had lost a great deal of blood. Elizabeth did her best to make him comfortable.
What is she saying? I don't know. Ask her if she speaks French. Parlez-vous français?
Mais oui. Vous êtes séparé de votre armée?
Oui, madame.
He said that they had lost their unit and were wandering through the Ardennes for the past 2 days and two nights.
Je vais changer les bandages.
She's going to change his bandage.
Fritz, hol doch bitte mal das Tuch, dann reiß ich.
My mother was all motherhood. She worried for them, and she worried for the wounded man, and she did everything she could. They were very nice. Like big boys from the neighborhood, you know.
So how you doing, kid? Have a nice Christmas, sonny boy?
Fritz's mother made the American GIs feel right at home.
He doesn't understand a word we're saying.
The men began to relax in anticipation of an unexpected Christmas dinner.
We thought automatically this must be more Americans. And I went to the door and opened the door. And there were four German soldiers.
Fröhliche Weihnachten.
I was petrified with fear.
Aber wir wurden von unserem Regiment getrennt.
He said, we have lost our units and we would like to warm up a little bit.
Sie können auch mit uns zu Abend
essen. So my mother said, you not only be allowed to warm up, but you get a nice dinner if you accept our guests.
Das für Gäste, Amerikaner etwa?
Ja. Soldaten. Einer davon ist verwundet und die sind genauso müde wie sie auch.
And my mother said, this is Christmas night and there will be no shooting around here.
Legt eure Waffen da ab.
Put your arms in the wooden shed and then we come outside and have a nice, nice Christmas.
Das Essen ist schon fast fertig.
Tut, was sie sagt. Leg die Waffen auf den Haufen ab und kommt rein. Ich habe Hunger.
Meanwhile, my mother had turned to the Americans, who by then had noticed that some Germans were coming, and had turned to their guns also.
Je vais les garder jusqu'à demain. Merci. Fritz. So, jetzt gehst du noch ein paar Kartoffeln holen.
My mother said to me, get more potatoes and more water.
Die sind alle hungrig.
We had more mouth to feed.
Setzen Sie sich doch, bitte. Essen ist gleich fertig.
For about a minute or two, maybe three, there was a tension.
Guten Abend. Hello.
But then it was warm, it smelled good, and right away there was a sense of hospitality.
You speak English?
Yes, a little. Your comrade, he's wounded?
Yeah, he got a round in the thigh earlier.
One of the German soldiers went over to the American that were wounded and asked the Americans in English what was wrong with him.
So what do you think? He's lucky. He's lost a lot of blood, but the cold has prevented the wound from getting infected. He should recover, provided he gets some rest and nourishment.
Good, good.
He had some first aid kit, and he applied a dressing to the wound. And the whole evening he would every now and then go and look after him.
That night, hostilities ceased in at least one corner of the forest, as American and German soldiers sat down together to honor the Christmas spirit.
My mother said grace.
Lieber Herrgott, wir danken dir,
It was not a regular prayer. It was something spontaneous. And she said that let's all thank the Lord for being together tonight, peaceful in this terrible war, and let's enjoy dinner, the little things that we have, and let's promise to be friendly to each other forever if possible. Let's also pray for an end of this terrible war so that we all can go home very soon. And by that time they were all crying. Not profusely, but the tears were rolling, you know, even the German sergeant, I was very surprised. And then we ate, and the tears disappeared. But from then on, there was a feeling of friendship that permeated the whole room. It was wonderful. I never forget.
For thousands of servicemen in 1944, it was hardly Christmas at all. In late November 1944, Allied soldiers were charged with holding the line at a small Belgian town called Bastogne. Word flew in that Hitler was pushing hard and fast, making a last-ditch effort to swing the tide of the war back in his favor. Bastogne proved strategic due to 7 crossroads that snaked through the town, roads vital in the transport of troops and ammunition. If Hitler could control Bastogne, he could win the war. The Allied soldiers were rushed up to Bastogne in trucks. They hiked out into the forest in the mud and the freezing rain, made a perimeter around the town, dug foxholes, and waited. Food, winter clothing, medical supplies, and ammunition were scarce. Some men didn't even have boots. They wrapped their feet in burlap bags to stay warm, all of it very reminiscent of Washington's siege at Valley Forge. The enemy made a larger ring around the Allied troops. They dug in and also waited. Snow began to fall. The temperature plummeted. It became Belgium's coldest winter in 30 years. The Allied soldiers guarding Bastogne were surrounded. Then the shelling began. Blood ran. Men on both sides took bullets, lost limbs, and died. Weeks wore on with little progress. Christmas neared. The two armies were positioned so closely together at night that Allied troops could hear their enemies across the line. They were huddled in their foxhole singing Silent Night in German. On Christmas Eve, 1944, General Anthony McAuliffe, commander of the 101st Airborne, issued a flyer to his men. It was headlined, Merry Christmas, and the general wrote, What's merry about all this, you ask? We're fighting, it's cold, and we aren't home. He went on to praise Allied troops for stopping flat everything the enemy was throwing at them. Then he described a story that happened 2 days earlier. On December 22nd, the commander of the German army had sent word to McAuliffe. The enemy commander had painted a bleak picture of the Allied position and insisted there was only one option to save the Allied troops from total annihilation. That option was full surrender. When McAuliffe read the demands, he fumed, then sent back the German commander a reply of only one word, nuts. When the messenger asked for further explanation, he was told, it's the equivalent of saying, go to hell.
It's just a matter of time till the bombs will start to fall, and all the rats in Tokyo will start to squeal and bawl. We won't forget to say, so sorry, excuse please. Then we'll kick the honorable seat of their pants clear down to their honorable knees. A lesson they're going to learn when we start getting rough. When Sherman said that war was hell, he didn't say half enough. They're going to regret the day they stabbed us in the back, 'cause something's got to fall apart when the Yankees start to smack.
My maternal grandfather was there in Bastogne at just 25 years old at the time. Yes, he marched and carried a rifle. But he was a communications specialist with language skills critical to the war effort. He also carried a radio and a typewriter. His last Christmas on Earth, that final Christmas Eve, he recorded his love of home and family, and knowing that it would be the last time he could wish any of them a Merry Christmas. Thousands of miles away in that Japanese relocation center in the West Deserts of Utah, my father laid his toddler head down to sleep as his mother, my grandmother, contemplated a great gift given to her by one of her Japanese students. In her time there, she came to love the Japanese people. These were not the enemy, she had decided. They were Americans. They spoke English. Many of them were multi-generational Americans, every bit as patriotic as members of her own family. And yet here they were, as Americans, spending Christmas behind barbed wire and guarded by men with guns. A sullen, miserable, and even shameful chapter in the history of America at war. The gift given to my grandmother from the first grade student was simply his ID card, the one possession each prisoner in that relocation center was instructed never to have off their person. Years later, Grandma told me this story and showed me the card, a gift she displayed alongside her tree for decades as part of her annual Christmas decorating in her home. And she explained to me what the card meant. Losing such a card would mean severe punishment, even for a child, even in an American setting. It was both their chain and their one ticket to freedom. It identified them not only by what they were named, but also where they were born. And this child was an American. The gift was one of pure love and sacrifice, the only possession this child viewed of any value that he could give to this American schoolteacher with the little baby boy that she would frequently bring to class. For my father and his parents, they were likely celebrating Christmas as they would later for years on end, even though their setting in the small hut given to them as a home in Topaz, Utah, had only paper walls to protect them all from the winter cold. There was likely a small tree with stockings hung, and likely as well a radio playing, when this news came across on Christmas Eve.
Major Glenn Miller, the well-known American band leader, is reported missing. He left England by air for Paris 9 days ago. Major Glenn Miller came over from the States early this year to direct the American band of the AEF, which has often been heard playing in the Allied Expeditionary Forces program of the BBC.
Meanwhile, in France and in England, Christmas 1944 represented their fifth consecutive Christmas at war. Living among the survivors were children that had never known Christmas without bombs. The 453rd Bomb Group was playing host to more than 1,250 British children who ranged in age from 4 to 14, many orphaned by the London Blitz. Someone had the idea of making toys for the children of Paris, children who had never experienced the joy and excitement of a child's Christmas. The idea spread very quickly between the officers and airmen. Even the neighboring children began donating their own toys or made new ones. Wooden toys, rag dolls, and thousands of Christmas cards were given with cheerful abandon to the young French allies. 300 children chosen by the American Red Cross to receive gifts on Christmas Day at the ARC Club at Rainbow Corner in Paris. The group received special permission to fly the gifts to Paris, and all French-speaking crew was chosen to ferry them over the channel. Sergeant Reuben Brockway was selected to portray Santa Claus, uniform and all, but without the traditional big belly. A B-24 replaced the traditional sleigh and reindeer, and base personnel contributed PX rations for stocking stuffers for the small guests. The venue was transformed with an eclectic array of Christmas decorations made from whatever was available. Soon children began to arrive in GI trucks, where they were grouped according to age. Those 4 to 7 were entertained at the Aero Club, where they received their toy and candy-filled stockings. Santa served them ice cream and Coca-Cola to their heart's content. Those 7 to 11 went to the flight line and were shown through the planes. And then came the big show. The procession walked to an area where a huge platform had been erected alongside one of the giant airships. It was the unnamed B-24H that was to carry the gifts so cheerfully donated to their little French friends. An 11-year-old orphan of the Blitz, Judith McDavid, christened the ship Liberty Run. The Liberty Run was later shot down over Germany, but for the moment it was Santa's sleigh, and Christmas Eve 1944 was one those children and those who served them would never forget. So why this review and these stories of Christmas 1944? Aren't all these stories in the end common to Christmas during World War II? If you Google Christmas 1944, you will find all these stories and many, many more on the internet. More than any other Christmas on record, I dare say, has the kind of memories associated with it that we find from Christmas 1944. And that's exactly the point. Nobody was home for Christmas in 1944, but many found Christmas anyway. It has been 70 years now since that Christmas of 1944 was celebrated. 70 years is a significant number in the cycles of Christmas history. You see, 70 years before 1944 was 1874, a time when Christmas transformed in American culture. Look it up. And then go back another 70 years to 1804, the Christmas that Lewis and Clark spent in the American Northwest. That, too, was a time of epic Christmas change in the history of the world. Go back another 70 years or so to the early 1730s. Look at Christmas music, at Christmas in politics in Europe and in the churches. It was another era of significant change in regards to Christmas and how it was recognized and appreciated. Go back another 70 years to the mid-1600s. Christmas was both banned and celebrated during an era of great change. Every 70 to 80 years or so, we see a new major chapter written in history. We are now on the cusp of Christmas change. Nobody foresaw in 1944 what Christmas change was coming then. The explosion in the love of Christmas after 1944 is easy to explain after a prolonged season of World War. But what has happened to it since? And more importantly, where is it going now? I could speculate. I could draw from today's headlines what it means to be a lover of Christmas. I could muse how the forever bubbling cauldron of controversy, the tug of war between the sacred and the secular of Christmas, is at the heart of Christmas yet to come. But I won't. I will let Christmas history write itself. I only say, watch. We are on the verge of Christmas history once again.
Of our fathers living still, in spite of dungeon, fire, and sword. Oh, how our hearts beat high with joy whene'er we hear that glory. Would be their children's fate if they, like them, could die for thee.
Faith of our fathers, holy faith, we will be true to thee. Faith of our fathers.
you are an artist with music to share, or perhaps an expert with an idea from the Merry Podcast that you'd like to get out there, please don't hesitate to email me, jeff@mymerrychristmas.com, to discuss the possible inclusion of your Christmas with our audience here on the Merry Podcast. Of special interest over the months ahead would be the big events and locations around the world for Christmas 2014. We'd like to hear more about your Christmas in your neck of the woods and what events are held, and perhaps even have some discussions with those who pull them off. Thank you for joining us on this merry episode, and we invite you to take in every past episode archived online for us at christmaspodcast.com. We thank all the artists and contributors who have made this episode of the Merry Podcast possible, including John Schmidt, who provides our theme music for this and every episode, and also the National Archives for recordings of World War II-era news reports and presidential speeches, to Paramount Pictures for clips and music from Going My Way, Bing Crosby and the John Stott Orchestra, Nat King Cole and the King Trio, Kate Smith, Wingle Minone, Perry Como, Frank Sinatra, Carson Robeson, Bob Wills and his Texas Playboys, the Mormon Tabernacle Choir, Glenn Miller and the Glenn Miller Orchestra, and the Army Air Force Band, the History Channel, and WestoverFamilyHistory.org, and Denver Darling and his Texas Cowhands. For MyMerryChristmas.com and all the sites on the Merry Network, this is Jeff Westover wishing you and yours a very Merry Christmas.